I am in the I'm finishing my PhD, and I know David because his advisor is my advisor. And I was trying to make David my advisor. We had a slight overlap, and we collaborated throughout my whole PhD, also like very heavily with Rohit. And I will be giving a talk today, which is supposed to converge eventually into my job talk.
So that's right. So, I should have introduced you, Janet,
It's okay.
because that's the normal form.
Sorry.
It's all right. And so yeah, so Joanna has been doing a lot of interesting things from video model control and understanding to understanding their representations of multimodal text and vision models and disentangling and understanding the contents of the representations, all sorts of very interesting things. And so her talk here, I think, is going to tie together a lot of these threads. And so we're looking forward to it. Thank you, Joanna.
Okay, maybe I'll stand up just to be more agile.
Oh yeah, by the way, so since this is like a practice job talk, if people want to take notes, we'll have like, would you prefer to have questions at the end or in the middle?
I mean, if there's like pressing something that you really want to share, please. But maybe let's try to keep it at the end.
And is there a time that you're trying to go for, like how many
No,
minutes or anything like that?
it's more
It's sort of open-ended.
vibes.
Yeah, I'm open-ended right
We're
now.
just we're yeah, it's we're not there
Okay.
yet.
Yeah, so but if people feel like taking notes, then we'll have sort of two qu kinds of questions at the end. One will be regular questions about what she talked about and the cool research, right? And then also just like suggestions on what would make more sense as a talk and just sort of the form of the talk.
Or like if you didn't understand something and or you feel like one part doesn't connect, I also have slide numbers. So you can refer to those if you have comments or
Okay.
consider. Okay, so the title of the talk is Steering Vision at Scale from Representation Space to Training Data. And so I believe that where we are right now with computer vision, specifically like with a lot of really powerful models like Gen AI, is somewhere where we were with this first automobile, right? So it's nobody can argue that it's a step change in the technology. Nobody can argue with the fact that, we're achieving things that we are nowhere thought to be possible, and it has amazing promise, but it's a little bit awkward. So this is the Mercedes-Benz patent. So it's arguably the first vehicle that was created, and I'm saying it's a little bit awkward because it was a little bit awkward to use, right? So we didn't have a lot of steerability and controllability. We basically had this. Which was dictating, which let us control the speed that was directly combined with the combustion engine behind it. If you wanted to brake, there was no brake. So if you wanted to brake, there was like a leather belt that was connected to the wheel, and that's kind of how you had to brake it. There was no reverse gear. So if you went somewhere awkward, you kind of had to push your car away from that spot. And there was no idle, so you had to kind of control the speed continuously. The other main controller there was this thing that was preceding the wheel, right? So first when we come up with technologies, they don't always hit just the right spot. They are not always as intuitive as you might want them to be. So right now we obviously have this really nice control wheel, but before you kind of had to control your direction this way, almost like a boat. And like I said, I think that we have this is undoubtedly an amazing technology that people have invented, and that's going to mark a huge milestone. But it's still a little bit awkward, right? So It's still a little bit awkward in the way that we interact with the model. So we have some spurious correlations because we basically focus on trying to learn from as much data as possible. And that data is not, it's not as intentional. It's just basically taking the whole internet that it is and trying to learn correlations that it has, but they're not always the ones that we want to learn. It's a little bit intuitive, right? If I ask for a specific prompt and I try to iterate it, I might get different images, but it might not be exactly what I want. If I say I don't want something in my image, I'm most certainly going to get it. And there are these different quirks that we have that are just not quite smooth yet. And obviously, our data can have undesirable properties. Like we have learned to generalize and put astronauts on horses in the moon, but we also learned violence, nudity, things that are somebody's intellectual property. And so, in this talk, I'm going to talk about some of the ways that I tried in my PhD to steer these models, to control them, to edit them, to make them a little bit more usable. So I'll be talking about how we can approach this problem from the representation space, how we can approach this problem directly from model weights, how we can customize and modulate the model's behavior. And lastly, if all fails, we can try to regain that control at the training data level. Okay, so let's start with the first talk of trying to control this model's behavior directly at the representation space. So this work is titled Disentangling Visual and Written Concepts in CLIP. And so here, for example, we're going to be talking about the CLIP model, which basically learns the shared representation space between text and images. And so if you have these two cups, surely what you think is they're both just cups, right? But CLIP, depending on this textual element in the image, is really confused. And so for this first image, it's surely a cup, but for the second image, it's surely a mom. It says mom. So that also happens if you try to use these representations in a generative way and try to basically generate an image using a test time optimization. So if I'll ask the model for peace, what will I get? Well, I get both P's as you would see them, but also the model tries to give me the full answer and says P's with the letter P's. So how can we isolate the visual from written? And so typically, CLIP learns this task of learning the shared embedding space between images and text. But what happens if I write the word text, if I render this on an image, how similar will that be? And so we did this test, and it turns out that we get a pretty good score. So if we do this image-to-image task where we try to relate the text, but instead of in this textual form on the image, we still get a very reasonable performance, 15%, compared to like zero shot, which is like 37 or 10 and 56. And if you think about like a random chance, this would be almost nothing. So the image thinks, the model thinks that these two images are similar. And so you might say, okay, that makes sense because maybe I've seen no. Okay, so now let's see what happens if I compare the image branch with the text branch. So before I compared image branch with image branch, and now what happens if I just replace completely this image of a dog? And then let's make it even harder because you might say, okay, but these are words, words happen in the real world. What if I take a random string and I see, are those image, like, does my model still think that the representations are similar? And turns out that yes, the model thinks that whatever is written on the image is very similar to the text space because we get a really high retrieval score on these both random strings as well as real words. So what we want to do in this work is we want to learn a projection on top of these representations that on one hand will learn only the visual things, or on the other hand will learn only the textual things. So for the textual things, we will create a data set with these elements. So each data point has these five elements, where we basically sample an image, a label string, a synthetic image text, where we just take a random text and put it on top of the image. Then we'll have natural image with text and the text corresponding to that synthetic image. And what we want to do on one hand is attract the representations that correlate to the textual side of things, and on the other hand, repel the representations of the visual thing. So these will be our training losses, and we're going to use them the same way as CLIP in this contrastive manner. So here again, these are our elements, and we're going to use these red losses to attract or repel, and then vice versa for the other projection. And so we can, run the numbers, we can do this test, and we can see that for this green task, we get really high performance. And then for the orange task, we get almost zero performance, which is exactly what we wanted. We wanted one test to perform really well and one really badly. And so let's look at the evaluation. We have learned some form of representation. What does it actually do, and how can I use it? So you know that with CLIP, people do all sorts of things. They use it as a retrieval embedding. They use it to condition text-to-vision models. So we want to see if our representation that we run is equally as versatile. So on one hand, let's look at this first task that we started with. We have these images, and you can see that in all of these examples, there's this confusion between the text and the visual. So let's do the same test, but now on the projected representations. So our forget to spell model forgets to spell. And then our learn to spell model predicts even more of these visual textual elements. And then we can also quantify that by using an off-the-shelf OCR model to actually predict, automatically evaluate how many letters do I have. And you can see that the CLIP model, which is the green one that's somewhere in the middle, the one that is supposed to learn text is much more, and then the one that's supposed to forget to spell has almost no detected words. And then lastly, I talked a little bit about the losses that we used and how we want to basically move the representations of certain elements together and of others away. But it's really important the way we do it. So we do need to put some constraint on the projection that we use, and that constraint has to be that orthogonality of our projection matrix, because we want to retain all the relationship between data. We don't want to just learn a random projection. And if we don't do it, then we can see that the representation collapses into something not very meaningful. And then lastly, we can also do a typographic attack evaluation, where we collected a data set of common objects, and we did a similar test where we put an abstractor on them in form of post-its with some text on it. And then we get the prediction on either CLIP or the model that forget to spell. And then we can see that for CLIP, there's this clear confusion on the diagonal for each image, which corresponds to the text labels. And then if we forget to spell, this confusion is greatly reduced. And then suddenly, lastly, we can see that the representations that we learned are quite robust to out of the main task. So here we do the same, but we do the OCR accuracy, but for the learn to spell model. And we can see that The performance of CLIP versus the performance of our model is almost the same. So we haven't really lost too much information. Okay, so here's one way that we can steer the representations of our model by working directly on this representation space. But maybe we want to do something more localized. Like maybe we don't want to move away from all of the visual concepts or all of the textual concepts. Maybe there's one particular concept that we want to target. So let's talk now about how we can make edits in the model weights. And this is the work where we did there on concept erasure. So we're going to be talking about erasing concepts from diffusion models, where the idea is that given the neural network, you want to make the model forget about specific concept by like cutting the connections or erasing these connections. And so in this paper, we basically use the model's own knowledge to erase concept from the weights. We don't need any additional training data. We just use the fact that the model knows how to generate specific things, and we want to make it forget. And the way we're going to do it is we're going to take the model theta star, retrain the model theta star, and we want to edit it to obtain a new model theta, such that its distribution is reshaped and it minimizes the distribution of seeing that concept given an image. And then we can rewrite this into this expression that looks something very similar to the classifier-free guidance, which is this technique used to train both an unconditional and conditional model together and add the test time sample from both of these models and have some kind of guidance over the strength of this concept. But now we're going to use this trick in the training time instead of the testing time, such that we can train our new edited model to be guided away from that concept. And so here's the full scheme of the model. We have our frozen model that knows about this concept, and we're going to fine-tune it such that we use the ideas of the classifier-free guidance at the training time instead of the testing time. And so we're going to be training it to guide it away from the model, given the model's knowledge. Okay, so let's see if it worked. Let's say I want to erase an artistic style. I'll choose in my artist of choice, Tyler Edlin, and this is the image it will generate. What happens if I ask for the exact same prompt, but a model where I erased the concept Tyler Edlin? So we get this image, and you can see that the content of the image is the same. So we still have the same layout. We still have landscapes with floating islands, but we don't have this characteristic style. Now, what happens if I ask for an unrelated artist? If I ask for an unrelated artist, I still get an image that looks like that because my erasure, my edit here, was localized to Tyler Edlin. And then, if you do it a bunch more times, you can see that we see this pattern across different erased concepts. So here on the left side, we have the original stable diffusion, on the right side, our method. And on the diagonal are images that are prompted with an artist that was also erased. And so you can see that that's the trend that we have, but on the off diagonal, the images are not really changing much. And so we can evaluate it. And we're going to ask people basically, how does our model compare, or in general, we are interested to see how do people perceive these images with respect to real artists? How do they perceive the erasure? And also importantly, how do they perceive preserving other styles? Because this is this trade-off where we both want to have a precise erasure, but at the same time, we want to preserve unrelated concepts. And so interestingly, the model is clever enough to know which concepts are close in the semantic space. So, for example, if I want to remove Paris iconic monument, that will be the tr training prompt concept that I use. At the inference time, my model will know that what is most likely is Eiffel Tower, and it's not going to this time. Okay, so we talked about erasing, shifting the whole representation space and steering it away from a class of concept. We talked about doing more specific edits on the model weights. But what if you already have a model, you kind of like it, but you just want to use it? So here I will be talking about two different approaches of making controlling the model so that for applications. Specifically, I'll be talking about customization and modulation. So content modulation is basically the principle of giving you this, again, precise control, but in a continuous space, which we don't really have. And in the real world, there's so many things that's kind of like the steering wheel. You can control it, but it's not really the natural move to make. And it's the same with text. If I want to express surprise, I can't easily describe to you the level of surprise. But I can do it. But I know that it's somewhere in between very surprised and a little bit surprised. And so this is what this work is going to allow us to do. So it's similar formulation to our previous work of raising concept, where now we want to re reweight this distribution. We want to get this new distribution that's basically reweighted between the C minus and C plus, so that we can modulate it. And then again, you can derive to a formulation that is again similar to the classifier free guidance. But the problem is that if you just use a specific ranges in words, they might be correlated with different attributes. So what you might want to do is define these ranges with preservation terms that let you basically find a more entangled direction in this disentangled direction in the space. And so here is again the model, and instead of fine-tuning the model, the entire model, we're just going to use this LoRa lightweight adapter. And so here are some results. You can see that we can manipulate attributes on this continuous axis and go from not smiling to smiling, from no makeup to makeup, or from between different ages. And you can see that everything else in the image remains consistent. So you have this really nice continuous control. You can do it on different dimensions, so you can control different attributes at the same time. And you can basically get this controllability in 2D. And then lastly, what's really interesting about this work is that again, it's a little intuitive how the model works, right? Because how the model works is it gives you the projection of the data, but it doesn't give you the data the way you would want it to. It gives you sort of a funhouse mirror of the data. And what it means is that some of your images in your training set are not good. Some of them are better. And the model actually knows which ones are good and bad because they usually come with text labels that describe them, like high quality image, 4K. And so if you just ask the model to move in that direction, it will fix its own artifacts. So that's what we did here with this special type of control, where we asked the model to basically increase the quality of its outputs. And so you can see that these are the two images overlaid. One's original and one's repaired, and you can see that this awkward artifact become fixed. So modulation is one thing, but no matter how great your model is, there's always going to be something that's not there because that might be just very related to you. Maybe that's something that exists only in your world and it's very private, and there's no reason for a model to just know about everything. So you should be able to customize your models. And this is what we're gonna talk about in this work, specifically in the context of text-to-video models. So previous works on text-to-video models focused a lot on copying motion and then kind of fixing everything else in the image. So typical directions are motion transfer or using some kind of source video that is supposed to drive the output video. So specifically, given an input video, you would give the system an input video, and you would want to have the same motion, the same scene geometry, the same moving subjects, and you would want to change the appearance a little bit. What I'm going to propose here is to go about it a bit differently. So in this work, I want to learn the motion, keep the motion fixed, but change the scene geometry, change the moving objects, and change the appearance. So I'm proposing a method that will only extract this motion pattern that might be something that's very personal and unique to you. And I want it to be able to use it in this huge text-to-video generator. And so just like you saw in this example, this would be the input videos where you have a lot of variations on how the people do it, who are the people that do it, how they look, where they are, and you just want to fix it and be able to use it for multiple people, for different viewpoints, for a different background. And so the way we're going to do it again is we're going to use the framework of text to video models. And so this model was actually a model that was adapted from an image to image text to image model and was inflated and trained for the video domain. And the way we're going to do it is we're going to identify the layers within that model that are most important for learning a new motion. And we're going to add a different sampling technique that will make the model focus on the coarser structure of the video, such as the motion, but rather ignore the appearance of the images. And we're going to adapt this fine-tuning method to basically add this new mapping between the videos and the motions and the output and the knowledge inside the video model. And then here are some qualitative examples of this. Okay. So here are some of the qualitative examples where we our training set was a single person doing a gesture in front of a web camera, but our model at the test time, when queried for children, can generalize this to multiple people. Additionally, we can interpolate between different motions. So even though our training set only contained this one single motion being done, here we can see a clown eating a burger with his other hand. So it's combining two motions together. And then lastly, we can also interpolate or maybe edit this motion in the text domain where we can ask for a variation of this motion being done very slowly and precisely. Okay, so now I think we're starting to have a little bit of a toolkit of what we can do with the models. We have the representation space, model weights, customization, modulation. But what if it all fails and I just really don't like this model and how what it's doing and the access that it has been given? So in this last work, we're going to be talking about opt-in models, where there's this whole controversy about being able basically to query an artist's name and generate outputs based on that. And we did propose to erase some of the artists, but I don't agree that that should be the way to go about things. People shouldn't have to opt out of something that the decision has been made for them. We should really try to make more exclusive models, like opt-in models, where I would first train a model that doesn't have any of these issues, that's only trained on natural images and photographs and doesn't contain any copyrighted material or paintings or graphic art. And then I want to see if I can control it again and add this again lightweight adapters, such that if I'm an artist and I want to be able to use this technology, but I want to use it knowing that whatever I'm producing reflects my personal style and not hundreds of thousands of different artists, I want to be able to do that. And so this is what we're going to talk about in this project. And so we're going to start with training the diffusion model, our blank canvas diffusion. And so in order to train a model, we need data. So we're going to create this blank canvas data set where we will look at a large collection of photographs. And so we will be using the SAM data set, which was used for object detection and segmentation. And per design, this data set doesn't contain any artwork. But obviously there's accidental artwork that happens everywhere, and so it's also not very clear what art is. So in order to be very due diligence about it, we're going to additionally filter out anything that might have seeped into the training. So we need to make some decision about what we want to keep or what we remove. And here's an illustration of this decision. So we can see that those images are definitely not an intentional art. But on the other hand, it can happen that you have paintings that are photographs of paintings rather than somebody's graphic art, or maybe they're photos taken in a gallery that are also not intentional art, but we still don't want any artistic influences. So this is where we're going to draw the line. And then additionally, we're going to check how well we did. So when I say we draw the line, we automatically filtered the data set on with two methods. So one method was using CLIP again, where we decided on text prompts that we're looking for and the thresholds, and we chose those thresholds with respect to the whole distribution of the data set. And we additionally looked at the text captions and removed anything related to art or paintings. And then we also did a manual verification where we looked at 10,000 images before and after filtering. And we found that before filtering, there was 36 paintings. And after, there was no painting. We still didn't quite perfectly get any artistic, all of the artistic influences, like sculptures or logos, but we targeted the problem of paintings in the data set. And if you don't believe me, here are some artistically ambiguous images that we found in the data set that are definitely more interesting than pure nature images, but are also not really copying anybody's style. And so we trained this model. We trained it from scratch. We trained the unit and the VAE from scratch, and we replaced the text encoder with replaced that you usually use CLIP with an image agnostic text encoder BERT, such that no artistic influences from the CLIP training data set can seep into our model. And we are doing so there's obviously a discrepancy between the training time and the number of images, but we find that our image, the images that we produce look visually pleasing. And so here are some samples from our model. So a group of people stands on the grassy hillside overlooking a majestic wide waterfall with misty spray set in a lush green forest. They likely enjoy the scene, serene natural beauty. Or the other one. So we can see that their model can generate visually pleasing images that are coherent with text. But what happens if I try to recreate famous art? So if I ask a popular model like Stable Diffusion, we get pretty much copies or replicas of these images, but our model just produces noise because it truly doesn't know anything about art. And so now the question is again, we have a model, we controlled the procedure of the training data and the training filtration. But how can we now interact with the model as an artist? So can artists opt into these technologies? And so again, we're going to train an adapter model. So given a small data set between 9 and 50 images of consensual images, we're going to annotate them either manually or automatically. We're going to annotate their content as best as we can, and we're going to add the suffix in style of VSTAR. And then we're going to again use a LoRA adapter to train with reconstruction loss such that the model can learn about this stuff. But if we just do that, we will probably overfit to these examples. So we need some form of regularization. And it happens to be that we already have a great prior of natural images, and we're going to use it. So now we're going to ask the model that every time I see this caption, I want, but without the suffix, I want to get an image that looks just like whatever is described in this image, without the style. And that helps the model to focus on the thing that these images have in common, which is the artistic style. And here are some results. So the setting is that we take our blank canvas diffusion, and here's our art example data set. These are all the images used to train this art style adaptation. And now if at the test time, we can prompt it with this prompt, and this prompt in reality also contains the suffix. So prompt would be a large ornate castle with a massive staircase leading up to it in the style of the star. And we suddenly get these images. And I think it's quite interesting because our model hasn't seen abstract art. It hasn't seen Monet, it hasn't seen all these graphic artists that are everywhere. The only art that it has had access to are those samples. And so you can see that it's very faithful to the style, but at the same time, it also looks like a castle with a staircase leading up to it. And that kind of generalizes across different styles. So if we have a Richter, which has this super abstract styles, and you suddenly ask it, for a silver trailer, this is the model's interpretation. So it tries to both inject his own style, but also be faithful to the prompt. And just another example with Gustav Klimt, who is known from painting this landscape images. When you suddenly ask it to draw children riding a roller coaster, it will still make do so, but in its own way. And one more, Jean Miró. This is again a very unique style. And now you can ask it for something so mundane, so prosaic, like a dining table set for tea with a variety of dishes and utensils. It will still do the task, even though probably Jean Miró would refuse. And then you can also apply it for a for the task of stylizing the image, where you would not only have as input the text prompt, but also a reference image, and you can combine it with this adapter as well. Again, just another example. And To evaluate this model, we both have a user study where we ask users to basically judge how similar are these images to the original style with respect to different methods. And on the other hand, we have an automatic evaluation that measures both the content score, so this is for the image reference task, how similar is the image to the image that we gave it as an input, and the style score. And so you can see that our model does a really good job compared to most of the baselines. We are not looking for it to be perfect, but we can see that for many of these works, the users are actually confused and do prefer our model, which has only seen really a handful of examples when we're comparing to the baseline that we're training on. Yeah, I'll look at it later.
Oh, yeah. Questions for later.
I'm almost done. And so lastly, we want to maybe get a little bit of an understanding or an insight of how can it be that, you know, even if I saw this 5, this 10 images of an artist, I suddenly can copy the style so well and coherent to the text prompt. So we're going to look at a data attribution method where we basically want to get a sense of which images in both of our training set have contributed the most to this generated image. And so given a generated image, we're going to compute scores with respect to every training example in both our original data set, the one that doesn't contain any art, and in our art style examples. And we can see that it's sort of a very clear disentanglement of where the model is getting the content information from and where the model is getting the style from. And that's kind of reflective here, right? So if we ask for a Mercedes-Benz sports car parked in the street, you know, we know about Mercedes-Benz, so it's not an issue to generate them. And we also know what's being asked for, which is this style. So the model figures out a way to merge them together. And similarly here, you know, we have this people dressed in medieval armor. No problem, we've seen that. And then we've seen also the way of stylizing images in Andy Warhol style. So the model just figures out how to combine those. Okay, so this is what I've been working on in my PhD. So we've looked at different ways of controlling the model, steering its behavior, steering its representation space, adding additional controller modes. And if all fails, we show that you can regain control of the model and still get really nice properties when you change some assumptions about your training data. And in the future, I really like this creative application side of computer vision. And so me and my advisor, also David, we had this dream in my first year of PhD where we wanted to see if it would be possible to basically disentangle the characters from the plot. So we wanted to see if it would be possible to watch Friends, but remake them such that the Friends now are mapped to the Lord of the Rings characters. And as you can see, we got this very awkward result that I didn't even publish. Like, it's published. It was a spotlight in a workshop, but I didn't even put online because the results are so ahead of its time. But I'm interested in this creative control because I do think that, you know, the way the where we are right now with these models is still not very intuitive. There's still much more control that we can gain over these representations. I'm also interested in how to make these models more intuitive to work with, more interactive, because we don't want to that's kind of how we operate. We don't do one fix at a time. We just keep refining our work over and over. And how to make this control collaborative. And then lastly, I don't think we're that far from personalized content generation, whether that's a short form one or long form one. The models already know so much about our preferences, and they're easy to personalize in ways where we can insert concepts. But what about driving the whole narrative as well as the individual elements of it? And that's it.
So content questions first before form suggestions. Any questions about any of the research?
I'll ask about like the clip questions.
Okay.
How is it that you wasn't like maybe I didn't understand it properly. How is it that you are controlling the representations to disentangle, but not the weights? What are you optimizing there in the clip work?
So you just train a projection layer on top of the representations. So you don't actually touch the model. You just train a matrix on top of like the final embeddings.
See.
If we had been really good at branding, we'd call it DAS.
Yeah.
DAS before it's time.
Wait, I had a similar question. So regarding the clip itself, I think you trained a like you trained something to disentangle the representations.
Back to the slide.
But I was wondering if you can actually localize it using like some sort of causal intervention. Localize the textual part of the information versus the visual part of the information in the actual intended representation instead of having to learn it using gradient descent.
Yeah, so when we looked at it, we found that it was quite interesting. So there's this website that shows like which like shows images that are the highest activations for every neuron. And the issue with that is I think that there's a lot of what's the name for it? Like the that basically the neurons have respond to different concepts. So we found neurons
What do they
that
call it? What multi-semantic? No, what do they call them?
polysemantic.
Polysemantic. These Chris Ola's crew and his names. But it's called polysemantic.
So you find neurons that are like super responsive to specific letter like B, but they're also super responsive to like ice. So I
Right.
think, isn't it called like decentralized or centralized representation or something?
Distributed representation.
Distributed representation, yeah.
I see, okay.
And it's actually the same clip that you, if you now do pip install clip and you do clip load, it's the same issues are still there. I mean, I know that some people are using open clip, but they haven't fixed that.
Sheridan had a question. Is that right, Sheridan? That you tapped into chat. I don't know if Sheridan is online.
Your capture has been since there are lots of images on the internet and
Oh,
so
Sheridan might be, yeah, might have had to sign up.
on.
So will you read Sheridan's question?
So Sheridan said, your method could capture artist style better than SD since there are lots of images on the internet in the style of Van Gogh that don't really look like Van Gogh, whereas with your method, you can make sure to only have good quality examples. That's good. I'm gonna
Oh yeah.
say that.
Oh yeah, that's right. That's interesting. Yeah.
I have a question. Am I
Go ahead.
audible or? Oh,
Yes, we can
okay.
hear you now.
Okay, so you mentioned like you're trying to find a disentangled direction, and I think it was the concept letters part.
Yeah.
But my question is like, are you like visually measuring the disentanglement, or like is there something that you're using?
I don't remember. Do we like how do we measure disentanglement? I
Yeah.
think we usually we
Did we measure interference in that paper? We did, right? Is there interference measured?
I think like one way we measure it is by LPIPS on the original image and seeing like what changes when we change that particular attribute. We did an ablation of how does it work if we don't use this preservation concept. I don't know if we have an automatic evaluation, but it definitely is, you know, it's pretty obvious that some concepts just correlate with particular attributes. So that's the motivation for it.
Okay, so basically, like usually these spurious correlations are like close to each other. Is that what you're saying? Like,
I
so
mean,
like, okay.
yeah, so you can see that if you don't do these preservation terms, you move in multiple different directions. You might change somebody's age, but you might also change somebody's like race.
Okay.
Another question, kind of slightly related to this disentanglement. So you had a few slides where you showed that you have removed Eiffel Tower from Paris. So now what happens if you just ask the model to generate Eiffel Tower? Does it still generate Eiffel Tower?
No, so you don't generate Eiffel Tower, that's the point.
No, you removed Eiffel Tower from Paris, but did the model forget what Eiffel Tower is like looks like?
I believe so, right? Because we if we query for Eiffel Tower,
Okay. Now my next question will be, why do you need to do anything fancy for that? Can't you just mess with the word embeddings of Eiffel Tower and get rid of like Eiffel Tower altogether?
you can do it, right? Like that's, you know, obviously. But you want to have some robust method because let's say I want to like make my model safer, right? And I add these filters on top of it and then I release it, you can turn off the filter. But if I make the edit inside of the model weights, you can't really bring it back that easily.
Yeah. Also, I get you don't want the model to forget what tower looks like, right? I mean, if you mess with Eiffel Tower, then it will also forget what like general tower looks like.
So that's more about like a permanent edit than simply like an inference job.
Also, you have I don't know if you have the example. Even if you ask for picture of Paris with its famous building,
Yeah.
you would still get Eiffel Tower. But if you just mess with the text embeddings, the model still knows what the famous building is.
Okay. Yeah, so you have other ways of getting to Eiffel Tower without specifying it in the text.
Yeah, I think
Yeah.
one of the figures is with the prompt.
So all of them have, maybe it's too small to read.
Yeah.
So
And also this is not just erasing Eiffel Tower from Paris. It's erasing Eiffel Tower, not the connection between it and Eiffel Tower and Paris.
I'm wondering with the artist erasure, how, if you have a way to quantify how fine-grained you're able to be with a specific artist. So, for example, all the examples you showed, all the artists have very distinct styles. But I imagine if in the future we want, let's say I'm an artist and I want to submit to have my work erased, art tends to operate within schools of style. So, is there a way to say whether, let's say, I want to erase Ghibli style from my, from my model. But let's say I make art in an anime style. Is there any way to quantify whether like you're being fine-grained with the artist erasure or if there's a lot of bleed over into similar styles?
yeah, so with this first method, there was some bleed over. So we could see that if we erase Rembrandt, you would have an effect on Van Gogh. But then we have a follow-up that is not in this slide deck that is a little bit more precise. But in yeah, so I think with that one you can do it both at scale and you can add like basically like you said, you can specify which artist you want to preserve. But maybe, maybe if you work in anime, you would want to do the last thing that we did, right? Where you just want to know there's no influence of anybody else, just me.
Yeah, this last one's the cleanest, right? Yeah.
And the last one, how many training examples do you need for that to work?
So we use between 9 and 50.
Oh, 9 and what?
9 and 50.
50. Interesting, 9 and 50.
50 or 150. 1.5.
5.0.
Thanks.
Also, I'm just wondering how good are these like data attribution methods in computer vision? So you had a slide probably in slide 86. So how good are they?
So that's a very open research problem. They're not very good, and if you think about data attribution in the sense of like gradient-based methods, this is just infeasible at this point at this scale. So there are methods that do it on like very small data sets and small models. If I was to do it on this model, it's just computationally prohibitive. It takes like 2 months on two like boxes. And also it doesn't really work that well. So what we use here is an approximation of that that is basically like fine-tuned clip, but it does it in a way that approximates attribution.
Is that a standard way of doing things?
That is actually a, that is like an established method. Yeah, it's still data attribution, still is in its infancy for computer vision.
Also, since we're talking about data, so when you're in this work, you were doing a little bit of filtering, and you showed that you reduced the number of data sets from 30 million to 9 million. Like, how are you doing filtering
I
in
think
that
from
scale?
10 million to 9 million.
Still, there's in millions. So how do you do filtering in that scale? Like, you can't possibly manually do it.
No, so we did it more automatically. So on one hand, we look at like click scores, and on the other hand, we look at the captions. And then we manually check the threshold for each category that we want to choose with respect to the whole distribution of the score.
Also in this work, in slide 70s, you had a regularization loss. Is that regularization loss meant for specificity, or is it kind of like making sure that the image you generate is getting similar to two different images?
So this loss is kind of similar to the way people do personalization for like static concepts in diffusion models, where if you like want to add a dog, you would have a regularization set so that the model doesn't associate all dogs with your dog. And so it's similar here, where it basically helps to generalize over the style better. And so it like focuses less on the specific examples. And like away from the concepts that they represent or where the concepts that are described in the con in the prompt, and lets them a little like disentangle the art from the content, the style from the content.
So when you calculate the reconstruction loss, you are making kind of like making sure that the image you generate, it is similar to two different things. One is the style and one is the actual contents. Is that correct?
Yeah. You can look at it that way because one image is supposed to be stylized, and then one image is supposed to be close to this natural image distribution.
So when I saw this slide, I was a little bit surprised because they seem like two very different things. How does it work? I mean, probably they balance each other, but it seem like doesn't this seem like very different things? Because reconstruction loss, it literally compares pixels. So I mean, it works. If it works, it works. But how does it work? That is kind of
Well,
like
because you're comparing the image generated by this model, which is the model. So you're taking this prompt, you pass it through the model that generates a natural looking image, and it's supposed to match dogs. So you're using this regularization from your
Joe, maybe the confusion is it's not the same prompt, right, for both these things.
It's not the same prompt, yeah.
Sorry, it's not the same prompt.
Because
I actually,
they only share the content part of the prompt, right?
content is see people walking along the riverside, okay, in the
And then
style of Vistar, okay.
Vistar is supposed to like make the connection between this thing. Images in the famous.
Yes, but when you combine them, the both of this thing and this thing are kind of like so you generate two images with two different prompts, and then you calculate the reconstruction loss and then you pass the gradient.
So on one hand, the target is this image from the data set.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, the target is the image coming from this model.
Yes.
And so when you pass the prompt, the suffix to this model with the adapter, you want to match the image with the image from the data set. When you pass this content without your suffix, you want this art adapter to just kind of output the same
like,
image as it would from this data
set. Okay, so it's kind of like a specificity loss.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yes, I actually had a wrong understanding. I thought that, okay, if you just combine them, these two, you suddenly get this thing, which is kind of like very unintuitive to me. Okay, thank you.
John, one question. So for sliders, you had to do some additional things to disentangle concept representations. Did you have to do something similar for video, or is that like some emergent capability where you didn't have to disentangle motion?
So for video, what we did is we had this sampling loss such that at the training time, you don't like sample uniformly each time step, but you skew the distribution, skew the probability of the time step towards being closer to the noise distribution. Because you know how like when you denoise the image, like the first stages are all about the structure, and then the later one kind of don't really change much, it's really finer grain. And so we skew that when we train, we mostly focus on the noise. So that, you know, the structure of the images is like, and that kind of helps.
Thank you, Joanna. Let me unpause this here and stop the recording. And then